Colonel Chaplin, Reel 2. What were the other servants that you employed in India, Colonel Chaplin, apart from your bearer?
In your bungalow, normally you had a beastie who was the water carrier, who produced your water for you. A Mali who was the gardener. And a mater or sweeper who dealt with the bathroom and so on, and your thunderbox. In addition to that, if you kept horses, you had a variety of servants with them. For instance, I had my army orderly who was looked after one of my horses, and a syce who looked after two other horses. One also, if you were playing polo, had somebody to help you with the training and looking after those horses. And it was normally a retired dufferdar or sergeant of the cavalry. I had a very good man who used to help me with my horses. In a bungalow or in the mess, you had, of course, your consommers or your cooks and your waiters or khitmatgars. And if you had children, you had ayahs as well, who were the women who looked after the babies, the small children. I think those are the main servants one had in the household.
Was your orderly a Sikh?
My orderly was a Sikh, yes.
Coming back to your first arrival in India, what was your first impression of the place?
I was very excited by the whole aspect of India. Everything was different. The scene on the quayside when the boat first came alongside was totally different. The people were dressed differently. They spoke a different language. Everything was new and really rather exciting. On the way up to Sibi, after we'd left Karachi, it was an impression of endless plain. You seem to be crossing these long stretches of plain, in some places cultivated, in some not, but vast expanses of land which I hadn't been used to. I think in the main you were looking forward to the new life with Indian soldiers, and it was all really very exciting.
Did you travel by means of a troop train from Karachi to Sibi?
No, I travelled on the ordinary train which goes through Hyderabad and Ahmedabad to Sibi. It was not particularly a troop train.
Was it like a train journey in England, or what were the differences?
No, there was a considerable difference. The carriage was a large carriage with four, the first class carriage was a large carriage with four bunks in it. The two bottom bunks where you could sit on, and the two top bunks were pulled up and rested again on chains and could be lowered at night time. Generally speaking, one didn't have more than two of you in one of those carriages, so you had a really large carriage for two people with its own shower and basin and little bathroom attached, and its own loo. In the middle part of the compartment between the two beds, you normally had a large zinc tray full of ice on which you kept your drinks and so on. And in addition to that, you normally carried chargals of water. A chargal is one of those canvas containers where the water keeps on seeping out and through evaporation keeps cold the whole time.
A canvas container supported by what?
Well, merely hanging from a strap or part of the canvas. It's rather like an elongated hot water bottle made of canvas.
And these were some kind of standard equipment, were they?
This was a standard equipment for the army in India, yes.
Why were you stationed first of all at Sibi? Was it a place which normally had a cantonment?
No. The earthquake had taken place in Quetta, and my regiment, the lines of which had been really rather badly damaged, was asked to move down to Sibi to relieve the congestion to a certain extent, and to make things easier from the point of view of supplies and so on. And they spent about a year in Sibi before returning to Quetta.
And what were conditions like at Sibi? Were you very uncomfortable?
No, I think we were very comfortable. We were in tents. But living in tents with the army in India, particularly from an officer's point of view, was always really a comfortable operation. You had a good tent, a good camp bedding, a chalumchi, which was your basin with a leather cover, in which you carried all your washing things. Your valise contained all your pillows and blankets and so on that you required, sheets. And you lived really rather comfortably. You were always very, very well looked after by your Indian soldiers in camp. They would, apart from always pitching your tent in a nice place, would always, if there were if you had no bed with you, would always produce rushes or something for you to sleep on in comfort.
And did they get a quid pro quo from the officers in the way of care?
Yes, I think so. It was always instilled into us that your men always came first. Then came your horses, and then finally came yourself. So that after a march, or on any occasion in difficulty, your first thought was always for your men, for the comfort of your men, and then, as I say, looking after your horses and mules, and finally yourself. And I think the Indian soldier appreciated this, and a very good relationship was built up. Officers took a tremendous interest in their soldiers. Any problems that the soldiers had, they always brought them to the officers, and they always had help, if possible, from the officers. The soldier tended to call the officer Maam Baap, which means in Urdu, mother and father. And that attitude, I think, was very important in the Indian Army.
What type of problems did they bring to you?
Well, there might be money problems. There was a tremendous amount of litigation in India. Sometimes land squabbles, sometimes squabbles about a wife. And very often they entailed a necessity for money of some sort. So very often we used to help them with money. If they had any personal problems or problems with other people in the arguments with other people in the regiment or in the battery, again, very often those problems came up in front of you and you had to sort them out and try and prevent whatever friction was taking place. There was always likely to be friction when you had a mixed Battery, for instance, we had Sikhs and Punjabi Muslims, and their habits and customs were different, and quite often there were little problems that arose that you had to sort out.
When you said that you help them with money, do you mean that you help them out of your own pocket or out of army funds?
Well, it was never out of army funds, but sometimes it was out of battery funds. You had certain funds which were belonging to the battery alone. And in certain cases, you might help them out of your own money. But that wasn't quite so often. It was it depended on the case very often.
And did you always get the money back?
Yes, I can't remember any cases where we didn't get the money back eventually. Sometimes they would they asked for a bit longer to pay and it was given, but they were very good about it.
Which language did you speak to the Sikhs and Punjabi Muslims who were working under you? Which language did you speak?
Urdu was the language we used. Urdu is the or was the lingua franca of the army in India. It's all the different races that were in the army had their own language as well, so that in our case they all spoke Punjabi, but they were all made to learn Urdu to a certain extent, so that one spoke to them in Urdu. I learnt a bit of Punjabi and sometimes used to speak to them in Punjabi, and very often they'd speak to me in Punjabi, which is very akin in many ways to Urdu.
What standard did you attain in Urdu?
I took the first class interpretership in Urdu and passed it.
And so what would that mean in practice? Did it mean that you were fluent in Urdu?
Oh yes, it's the same standard as an interpretership in this country today for any language. It meant that, among other things, you were allowed to examine young officers who took their lower and higher standards. There were two standards that were normally passed by British officers. You passed your lower standard first and then your higher standard. And you were not allowed to get any leave in a mountain regiment until you had passed your higher standard. And then on from there to interpretship was quite a big step. It meant a lot of study and a tremendous amount of... I had to, when I was in Ambala later on and took the internship, I had to cycle down to the cinema on quite a few evenings and go through a whole rather boring Indian film merely to get used to the language. And you had to try and get all aspects of it. You had to learn about the different religions and be able to talk about the different religions in Urdu. You had to know all the new technical phrases because there were lots of new things being invented and they were given Urdu names, and each day there were a new set of things that the Urdu papers had invented. So it meant reading the Urdu newspapers very carefully each day too. It did involve a lot of work.
Which newspapers were there?
Inqilab was one, I think. And there was a translation, and I can't remember the name of the British newspaper that it was translated from. It was the ordinary Gazette, the Indian Gazette, I think it was, something like that.
Civil and Military Gazette.
Civil and Military Gazette, I think, yes.
Inqilab, was it some kind of strongly militant political journal?
Yes, I think to a certain extent it tended to be. It was...
What does Inqilab mean?
Revolution.
And so was it an anti-British journal?
Yes, in some ways it was, but it did give a lot of good information. And a lot of good Urdu, it was well written.
Was it entirely private study then, your Urdu?
Yes, it was.
You never had a munchie?
Oh, yes, no, you had munchies the whole time. But, I mean, it was, you paid for your munchies and you just carried on studying. I used to do anything from 1 to 2 hours every day with a munchie, in addition to whatever else I did.
Did you enjoy learning the language?
Very much, very much. And, of course, it was a very great asset later on with the soldiers, because you could take part with them in a way that you couldn't without the knowledge of the language. You could make jokes, you could catch every intonation of theirs. Sometimes one tended to not really to understand what was going on too much, but you it was a great asset to know it, to know the language really well.
Were you able to read Urdu literature?
Yes. I tried to read as many books as I could. There isn't all that much literature, actually, but there were certain set books that one had to study. One, I think that was for the higher standard, but a thing called Guldasta-el-Urdu was one of the many books that I still have, which one had to read up.
Can you recollect any works of literature that you read?
I read quite a lot of translations of British books, of British literature, but I didn't really know any pure Indian literature that I...
Did you learn any other Indian languages apart from Urdu and Punjabi?
No, I had a smattering of, or hardly even a smattering, but a few words of Pashto, because at one stage I was whipping into the Peshawar Vale, the PVH, and one met a lot of Pathans then, and one had to know a few phrases just to enable you to get along and do what you were supposed to be doing, which was generally looking for a hound, but...
Looking for?
For a hound.
A hound?
In other words, you came back from a hunt and you'd lost a hound,
yes.
And you had to go out into the country and look for it, and you'd have to ask the local farmers whether they'd seen a dog. As far as I can remember, have you seen a dog or have you seen a hound? Sounded something like spake diddle dee dee, which was always seemed to me a rather incredible way of talking.
In Pashto.
Yeah. But I may be wrong, it's a long time ago.
The unit with to which you were attached at Sibi was what?
It was the 24th Mountain Regiment, and it was composed of three mountain batteries, that's three Indian mountain batteries, and one British light battery, as it was called.
And you were attached to which battery?
I was in 16 Zobe Mountain Battery.
And was that that was one of the Indian batteries, of course?
Yes.
Why did they call it the Zobe Mountain Battery?
All the Indian batteries had a name given to them. Some of them were because of operations that they took part in, or because of people who raised them. They had the name of the person who'd raised the battery, or in some cases from where they were recruited, and in some other cases merely they were given a name when the names were first given and they happened to be stationed there. 16 Zobe Mountain Battery, I think, got its name from having been in the Zobe when the names were first issued, the mountain batteries. But then you had batteries like 6 Jacobs Mountain Battery, raised by a man called Jacobs, and the 1st Royal Kahat Mountain Battery, which... were given the name Royal for the whole of the mountain artillery.
Where is Zob?
Zob is in between Quetta and Fort Sandeman in Baluchistan.
When you went up to Quetta in March 1936, after staying at Sibi, did the city still show any signs of the great earthquake that had occurred just before?
Oh yes, the city was still in complete ruin. In fact, we were still clearing out bodies and clearing up the mess in general. The city had been completely ruined. Then, in the area where our lines were, in the cantonment, the shock hadn't been so bad. And although buildings had been badly affected, some of them had been completely demolished, some of them had only been badly cracked. So that in that area, people could used to live in, we lived for quite a long time, in Wana huts. Now, Wana huts were brick walls with a fireplace and a tent roof. A square, something like 14 foot by 14 foot, with a tent roof. Further away from the city, where the staff college had been and the shock had been considerably less, people were still allowed to stay in their bungalows, because the bungalows hadn't been badly damaged, but they had to be prepared to get out at once if there was any sign of any movement, any quakes at all.
And did any afterquakes occur whilst you were there?
Yes, I personally noticed, I think, perhaps two, where the light in my Wana hut, hanging from the top of the hut, swung a little to show me that there had been movement. But for a long time, I found it very disconcerting at dinner parties, because you'd suddenly find in the middle of a dinner party that on the first occasion, I was sitting there and everybody got up and rushed outside into the garden. And I got up a bit later and went out and said, what is all that about? And they said, didn't you feel the earthquake? And I'd felt nothing at all. So that people were very sensitive to any movement of any sort.
And did anything serious, in fact, occur after the great earthquake?
Not to my knowledge, no. No, I don't think so.
These Wana huts, how did they get their name?
Well, Wana was a place on the frontier. I think they were, people were in tents, or people who were put into tents needed a certain amount of protection from cold in a fireplace. And the only way of doing it was to make the tent walls of brick and a fireplace in it and keep the tent roof. And of course, for the earthquake conditions, they were very suitable, because if there had been another earthquake, you were perfectly safe in your bed, and only the tent roof would come down on top of you.
So they were really a recent innovation.
Yes, I think so. I don't know whether they'd been used much before the earthquake.
I think you told me that when you arrived in Quetta, you'd heard some stories about what it was like immediately after the earthquake, and how they dealt with looting.
Yes, there were some exceptional cases where looters had to be shot, and they had to be shot on site if they were caught in the act. It had been made quite clear that nobody was allowed back at that stage into the area, and dead bodies were being cleared out at the time. I merely say this as hearsay. I had no experience of it myself. But I do remember one case of a person who was in the staff college at the time, who was sleeping on the lawn, as one often did. You took your bed out onto the lawn with the mosquito net, and you slept there so that it would be cool. And he said that he didn't know what was happening, but he felt something was happening, and he jumped out of his bed. And the ground seemed to be coming at him in waves, waves about 10 foot high. This is the impression he got. And he was thrown onto his face. And he said he lay there with these waves sort of going on. They couldn't have been 10 foot high, but certainly with the undulations going on and on. Then there was a tremendous crash. I mean, something, it was, I suppose, 3 miles away, but it was the city coming down. And then there was complete silence for a few seconds, and then a horrible wail went up everywhere. And he said it was really most eerie, this silence, and then cries, everybody crying and wailing. And then, of course, he realized that the crash had been the city going down, and survivors were the ones crying.
Was the training which you did in India different in any respects to the training which you would have done in England?
Yes, I think in many ways it was. I think first I better give you some idea of what our cycle of training, both in England and in India, was. You started off the year of training with what was called individual training. That meant that you were, as individuals, all perfecting your own specializations. It might be that you were a signaler, you were perfecting your signaling, or you were a gunner, you were perfecting your laying of the gun, you were a trumpeter, you were blowing your trumpet, and so on. You're all doing your individual skills. Then you went on to a thing which was called, in the artillery, section training. And that is the part that affected me personally, because I was the section commander of the Sikh section. And then that developed onto your battery training, regimental training, and then finally the bigger stuff, if possible, divisional or brigade training. Now, as far as the individual training was concerned, we had certain skills to do in mountain artillery which I'd never had before in the other types of artillery. For instance, our drivers carried swords. They carried a type of cutlass to if they were attacked by Pathans, that was their form of weapon against the Pathan knife. It was almost outdated by the time I got to India, but they still had them. They still carried these cutlasses, and we still had to do cutlass drill. So that was one thing that was entirely new to me. The officers all had to do sword drill anyway, mostly for ceremonial parades. Then, in a mountain battery, you had to. The gun was carried in 8 pieces. And it comes up, and when you get into action, you have to put all those 8 pieces together to form your 3-7 howitzer. Now, that was entirely new. The drill, you spend hours and hours and hours trying to work down your timing into action. The timing was normally from the order action front to when you fired a round of blank out of the gun. We perfected it eventually in my section into 1 minute 30 seconds, which was very, very good. I mean, it could vary anything between that and 2 minutes 30. The training, once you got onto the section and battery training, was also different in that most of your work in mountain artillery at that stage on the frontier was picketing. A column advancing along a road would have to send pickets up the hills or mountains on both sides so that the Pathan could not get into a command.